And the Ragamuffins recorded a demo.
Yes, we did.
Demo tape or a demo record. Where was that done?
Wow, can't remember the exact studio. It was in Hollywood, though. And we had a photo taken with the three of us. It's in the album cover, in the album liner notes, The Ultimate Turn On by The Music Machine.
So the Ragamuffins have a steady job in San Pedro, too?
We had a couple of little jobs, yeah, a couple of dives played there. Guys were there, yeah, they were carrying guns and everything, and they would feed us, and we'd play for almost nothing. But that's where the Music Machine really began back in those days. With that trio there, Ragamuffins. Mm-hmm. Not very many people know about that.
What kind of response did the Ragamuffins get to their demo?
Well, it didn't really go anywhere. Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart produced it. There was three, maybe four demos we did. I can't remember exactly which ones they were. I would if I heard them. But they were certainly later on they were put on an album as better cuts, you know, that we did later on.
So there's a transition here then when you pick up some additional musicians and transform into the Music Machine. How does all that come
about? Well, you know, Sean at that point in time was not a very good lead guitarist. So that was that's what we were into, is finding out we wanted to get another lead guitarist. We initially, this guy, his name was Jerry Yearwood, he showed up, but he was from the old school, you know, time where he liked to jump on tables and stuff and eat his guitar and play it backwards, and it was all about the show.
By eating it, you mean play it with his teeth?
Sure. Just like Jimmy did in one, you know, Jimi Hendrix did.
Yeah.
You know, at one that time and space. But anyway, that's what he would like to do, you know. But his wife was real controlling. And when Sean says, you know, I think we ought to dye our hair. Well, we won't go with any earrings. We'll just dye our hair. And we'll wear all black. We'll go with that bohemian look, you know. And we'll use some chains and we might even do something that will really set us apart from all other bands. And I said, well, what would that be? He said, why don't we wear a black glove? And we'll wear that on stage. And if we need to, you can wear it on either hand, whatever hand you're more comfortable with, you know. So, you know, Mark would be chopping off the fingertips and so he could play, you know, with his guitar, you know. And I wore it on my right hand because I played traditional grip this way. And, I couldn't play it that way. It would slip. But after a while, the leather on these gloves would get so sweaty that it just mold right into your fingers, you know, and it would be almost better than... And we used to do all these clubs, like down in Biloxi and stuff, and sweat our asses off. It was just unbelievable.
Now, the all-black look, though,
yeah,
had already been with the Goldbriars.
Partially, yeah, because we wore black turtlenecks.
Okay, and you dyed your hair black.
Yeah, and we had an earring, too.
Okay, so in a sense, the black glove replaces the earring...
No. The earring, to some people, meant that you were gay.
Oh.
If it was in your right ear.
Oh, okay.
Right? And so that wasn't going to be a part of the band. The earring portion of it was not going to be admitted to the band because, well, we were all straight. Mm-hmm. Right? So I could, you know, at least that's my... my version of it. Maybe he just Sean didn't feel as though it was a unifying issue, but the black glove certainly was.
And he talks about that as being a unifying image.
Yes.
Yeah. So Sean had a real concept here for the image of a band.
Most definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was different than most other bands, or all other bands maybe at the time.
Correct. Without. Yeah,
so,
no doubt.
So Jerry Yearwood, mm-hmm. doesn't work out.
No, and you know, he was like into skin diving and stuff, and the murky waters of Santa Monica Beach, and you know, it just wasn't happening. And his wife didn't want him to, you know, be in the band, and because he was, you know, had to dye his hair, wear black, and stuff. So
Jerry Yearwood, is he ever hired or just briefly?
No, we rehearsed with him or practiced with him, I like to call it. And before we got a chance to really play anywhere with him, you know, his wife just would not, you know, go along with the whole deal. Just didn't like the band, period. So who didn't like the image, didn't like, you know, she was very, like I said, she was very controlling. And he just, you know, took off. And so I think he went back to Indiana or wherever he was from. And then when he heard Talk Talk on the radio, of course, we were playing it, you know. Then he just wanted to get back in the band. You know, he would have done anything to get back in the band. But that time we had Mark Landon.
Where does Mark Landon come from?
Mark Landon was working in a music store at the time. Of course, he can speak for himself. I don't want to do that. But I'm just saying that he joined the band first. And then Doug Rhodes... and then we were playing as a quartet, and then I was staying with Doug Rhodes at one point in this apartment hotel, and I said, hey, you gotta join this band. You know, this is really a hot band. You could have fun, and we could make some money, and we also need a keyboard guy. And I know that you can play multiple instruments, and keyboard, of course, is one of them. And so he finally said, yeah, and we started rehearsing as a quintet, and we called it the Music Machine.
And again, I assume Sean comes up with this name, the Music Machine, or?
Yes.
Okay. And you're still practicing at the garage on Almira Street?
Yes.
In San Pedro?
Mm-hmm. We practice just about every day.
How many hours?
Oh, you just go, you know. I could tell what Keith was going to do before he played it, and the bass player, and he knew what I was going to do. And Mark would play the lead lines, and Doug would play keys and bass in the band and flute in the band. Doug could play a lot of instruments. No doubt probably the most talented in terms of versatility in the band, and a hell of a guy. I really like Doug.
So it's really in this garage in San Pedro that the Music Machine are born as a band.
The Music Machine, yes, correct.
Yeah. And prior to that, you had been, as the Ragamuffins, you had developed the image.
But we also rehearsed there as well.
And rehearsed there as well.
The same place, the same garage.
Did people hang out outside the garage to hear the band?
They used to, yeah, play? The kids did. Yeah, they'd come around and they'd hang out and just... You know, because we do it during the daytime and everybody was working. So there was nobody in the neighborhood, basically. Everybody was working, right, trying to pay off their mortgages or whatever. And sometimes we just close the door, and other times we'd have it wide open, and we would rehearse this stuff, you know. Brian Ross, our to-be producer, he would come out once in a while and put his 2 cents worth in, and he's credited... largely in the ultimate turn on by Alex Paleo. And you know, his personality was I don't want to say in conflict, but oftentimes we just wanted him to stay out of the way in terms of contribution to the band because of the sound. And Sean basically wouldn't allow a lot of that going on anyway, because we were too busy doing our own thing. Basically, that's it.
Keith is quoted as saying, it was a real simple formula. We practiced and practiced and practiced some more.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
That's true.
Yeah. Just rehearse ourselves to death.
All originals now written by Sean.
The ones that... that we were recording, yes. And we did very few covers.
How does Talk Talk come about as a single? What's the story behind the song?
Well, we had rehearsed Talk Talk. Sean wrote it, of course, and it went through a couple of different phases. If you were to listen to the ultimate turn-on...
The reissue?
Yes. It has a lot of rehearsal sounds on it, and you can see where the developments of the songs went on it. So from that standpoint, it was also rehearsed, you know, in the garage. All the material from those, from that record was, and which is really the essence, in my opinion, it's the best of the Music Machine in terms of performance and recording.
Mm-hmm. How do you connect with Art LeBeau and Original Sound Records?
Well, we were shopping the tune around.
Okay.
And the image and the whole deal. We went to Atlantic and Liberty Records, and they're all along the Sunset Strip. There was a lot of them. RCA, Warner Brothers. You know, I mean, they're all, Sean and I and the rest of the band, whenever they could or whoever wanted to go, you know. Art LeBeau just gave us an offer and also said, hey, you can record right upstairs. Because there was a recording studio up there, and his name was, who ran it, was Paul Buff. Now, Paul Buff actually invented one of the first 10-track recording machines.
10-track was not common at the time.
No, they were just, they had these little Ampex of two-channel machines back in those days. It was just, they were very simple and efficient, and then you just overdub, you know. But if you can get multi-track going, that's what you want. You know?
But you had already recorded Talk Talk, right?
No, we had recorded Talk Talk at RCA Victor.
Okay.
And that's when we had a little money to be able to do that. We wanted to record that sound at that place. And we did a lot of our tunes there, but we did a lot of the first album songs, including like Taxman and 96 Tears and Cherry and on the first album, because Art LeBeau said, you know, you got to have these covers on here. It's the only way you're going to sell any records. Well, if we had stuck to our original material, I think we would have done a lot better, actually, because the follow-ups, although they, in my opinion, not the ones I would have chosen for a follow-up to Talk Talk, but they gained a certain amount of respect. Although the marketing of the songs wasn't there, you know. See, the main idea when you have a hit record is the record company says, you got to go out on the road now and push this thing. You know why? Because we want to make money on this, because we make the record. We made the record and we want to sell the record, right? So, but the interesting thing about it is that the record, when you go to Chicago or you go to... what is that? Another one of those. Oklahoma City, or if you go to, you know, any place, the record's got to be there before you get there.
Right.
So that when you get there, you can go on a promo and you can go, hi, my name is Ron Edgar, and you got to be at the Galveston Armory on Tuesday night at 7:30 and see the Music Machine. And then Keith would go on and say, hi, my name is Keith. You know what I mean? So we'd go on and we'd do all these little promos and that. And sure enough, you'd get 1,400 or 1,500 people in there because they were all listening to Talk Talk on the radio. But the only problem is, where's the record? Go to a record store. We didn't get them. I ordered them when they were doing, you know, whatever. They couldn't get the records there before you were there.
Did you know it was a hit right after?
Oh, definitely.
Right away?
I knew it was a hit when we finally rehearsed Talk Talk before we took it into RCA record company.
Now, was
into
there
a studio?
Is the demo version of Talk Talk recorded at RCA the same version that's on the...
I don't think so.
There was another version recorded?
Well, we certainly rehearsed the hell out of it. That was enough. By the time we had talked to a place of where it really kicked. I don't think we even needed to have to do a demo. Because it went through some phases. It always went through phases when we rehearsed. You know, the arrangement would change a little bit. If the arrangement ever got dull, Sean would always say, no, let's do something in here like this. Let's put a little bit of 3/4 time in here, or this or that, and do something with that cymbal over there. Da, da. And I'll make sure you don't play on that ride cymbal all the time, because I have to do this with my ear, you know, put his hand cupped around his ear so that he can hear, right?
Talking about playing live.
Yes. Yeah. Well, even if you were in the garage doing a little tape or something, you know, he'd be up there like this, right? Mm-hmm. A Marlboro in one hand and, you know, his hand, you know, singing, because that's the way he could hear.
Was there a debate about the first 45, what was going to be the A side or the B side?
Yeah, there was some scuttlebutt about that. There was some about something about come on in, meaning they wanted for the A side.
That turned out to be the B side.
That turned out to be the B side to the 45.
Right. Okay.
And then the first album was definitely the breadwinner of all the records.
So on that first album, there's songs recorded at RCA and also at Original Sound.
Yes.
Okay.
The best of my knowledge, yeah. Not many, though. We did a lot of that album there at Original Sound because Art LeBeau wanted it done. And we just come off this road trip, like I mentioned before, and we were cooked, just burnt.
You remember the first time you heard Talk Talk on the radio?
I do.
What were you doing?
We were driving somewhere on a gig, or it might have even been like when it was just released, and we were driving out to San Pedro for another rehearsal. It was released, you know. It was Art LeBeau released, you know, Brian Ross, and, you know what I mean? And it took off. And it had a fan base. You would not believe the fan base. All these kids and everything, they'd call up. That's how you got your record played.
You're talking about kids calling the radio stations to request
sure.
the song?
Sure. Oh, I heard this song, da, da, da. You know, and then they listen to it. And then they get tired of everybody calling up, right? And then they finally play it one time. Well, they play that 1 minute and 50-second second tune, I'll tell you that, and it just kicked everybody's asses. They just loved it, I'll tell you. They used to use it between commercials a lot because it was short, a nice short little tune.
Was that behind the thinking of Art LeBeau to get a short song on the top 10?
No.
Or that wasn't?
I don't think Art LeBeau had really anything to do with the way that we recorded our tunes at all.
Okay.
He left us alone, pretty much. Sean was definitely the leader of that group, and what he wanted is that's what went on. And I'm actually glad that it did, because even to this day, fanatical Music Machine people love that whole dark image thing.
There were no other bands doing that at the time.
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. There were bands that, after the Music Machine broke up, of course, they all stole the image. Mm-hmm. Even to this day. I mean, everybody wears black when they play.
What were some of the places you played around Los Angeles?
Well, I'll tell you, the first place that we really got it together was Hollywood Legion Lanes.
A bowling alley?
A bowling alley, right. They, even to this day, there are rock groups in bowling alleys. But back in those days, it was just a lounge. It was a place to, you know, to play. And everybody came to see us play. You know, a lot of friends of mine who were just around us all the time came and saw us play. Kurt Betcher, the one of Goldbriars, he was there one night, came and saw us. A really good friend of mine, Joe Brule, excellent guitarist and a beautiful person, he came and saw us play, and he was been a friend of mine for 40 years, you know. So, but I'm talking about the fanatical people now. Like when we played in 2001, I think it was, wasn't that when they got hit, the towers got hit, 2001?
Mm-hmm.
It was that November round Halloween. Everybody was running around crazy in in costumes and stuff, throwing up in the streets and Greenwich Village.
Are you talking about a reunion concert?
Yes. Yes. Sean and I got together a backup band called the Fuzz Tones.
Let's hold off on that.
Okay.
Let's hold off on that.
All right.
So Talk Talk comes out and it's a hit right away.
Yes.
How does it affect the band?
Oh, we were all just jazzed. I mean, it was fantastic because we were all starving, you know. I mean, it was all like doing nothing, and there was, you know, it was just nothing happening, you know. Mm-hmm. Something like that happens to you, it really gets in your blood.
Now, was this song a vehicle to get you on those local televised shows out
definitely.
Of LA?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
What were some of those places?
Well, I remember Where the Action Is, Shebang, Hullabaloo, Boss City, some of those shows like that.
These are all televised?
These are all televised shows, yes.
All lip-synced?
Yes.
Okay.
And the reason is because they might have 10 bands all taping in the same day.
Right.
And obviously, you know, setting something, you know, setting microphones up and sound systems and everything like that, that wasn't going to go.
Where was the Hullabaloo located?
The club?
Yeah.
Sunset and Vine.
What was it? Could you describe that for us?
Oh, it was a fantastic place. It held about, 1,600 people, maybe 1,700 people. Just, they jam them in there. It had a revolving stage and a couple of draw curtains, velvet curtains, you know. It was called back in those days, way back in the days, the Moulin Rouge. It was a 50s. Show club, and then it became the Hullabaloo, and then later on during the after Aquarius came, the song Aquarius came out, mm-hmm. It became the Aquarius Theater, but during our time it was called the Hullabaloo, and it had a, like I say, it had a revolving stage in it, and in a walkout that, you know, Sean would go out and he'd sing this little tune that we did called Hey Joe. And it was, it just tear him up. It was a really fun tune. He started out real soft and that old Hey Joe song. And then he'd have those girls crying, man. It was just funny.
So you're doing a slowed down cover version of Hey Joe. Had you heard it by The Leaves or Love?
Yes,
or?
They both did it. A lot of groups did it, actually.
But they did it the fast version.
Yeah, there were faster versions.
Until the Jimi Hendrix version is known as the slow version.
Yeah, it is more of a slower version. Yes, that's correct.
But your slow version is prior to Jimi Hendrix.
Yes, prior, yes. And it was really a well-constructed tune that had a big climax at the end, and it had a lot of dynamics in it. That's what I really liked about it.
So was it Sean's idea to slow down Hey Joe and make it more of a slower version compared
yes.
to the commercial version?
Yeah, he had pretty much arranged, was the lead arranger of the Music Machine on all songs.
Right.
But Doug and I and Keith really contributed a lot in terms of the harmony, rhythm. Sean very rarely ever spoon-fed me, you know, any parts at all. There was only a few like little rules that were sonic oriented, like don't play your ride cymbal when I'm singing. Other than that particular one, I was pretty much on my own. I devised just about all my own parts. You see, being in a band like that with a leader who is very much in control of the sound of the band, you get an impression of where he's going with it. And so when you're designing a part yourself, creating a part yourself, once you get on a thematic system of how you play, in my case, then that's just what you do, you know. I mean, that's how I start interpreting what he's saying to you.